Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Welcome to The Conversation's Pre-Budget Politics Podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Health has been a battleground for the Abbott government. The Medicare co-payment was rejected by the electorate and never had a hope of getting Senate approval. Pharmacists have been concerned that the government might allow pharmacies in major supermarket chains and have worried about the deal they'll get under a new five-year agreement. Health Minister Susan Lee was given the tough job of announcing the back down on the co-payment early in her time in the portfolio. She has since entered negotiations with the Australian Medical Association over Medicare reform, and she's battled with the pharmacists for a new agreement. We spoke with Susan Lee about Medicare, the coming budget, being a woman in cabinet, the AMA, and more. Susan Lee, thanks for talking with us on Budget Eve. The Medicare co-payment proved a poison pill in last year's budget. Do you think that the health measures this time will get a better reception?
Many of those measures have already been discussed, Michelle, and it's terrific to reintroduce them in this budget. Key replacements, if you like, of the Medicare co-payment measure is the work we're doing with clinicians to both reform our approach to primary care as well as modernise the MBS so that it reflects contemporary practice instead of some outdated medical procedures that no longer happen. And while new and innovative approaches to practice are being introduced in doctor surgeries, they're not necessarily on the MBS in the way that they need to be. So that's just a vital piece of work that our clinicians will be leading, Dr. Bruce Robinson, Dean of the University of Sydney Medical School, and other experts well received by their peers across the sector will be doing this work with us. So I'm delighted to be able to talk about that. And again, primary care and our approach to chronic disease is, if you like, the other half of that process.
Now, I know you've said that these health reviews that you've set up aren't necessarily all about savings, even primarily about savings, but do you think that you will get substantial savings from them in the end? And I presume they're not factored into this budget, those savings.
That's right, they're not. If we can realise efficiencies through this work, then we are happy to say to the medical profession, let's reinvest for the health of all Australians, and let's reinvest in the government repaying the national debt and the budget. But I haven't structured anything formal around this, and I know that the clinicians are working with us in goodwill. This is not about the Department of Health with a target list or a hit list or a figure that we're reaching. This is a genuine reform. But look, everywhere I go, people say there is waste and inefficiency in the system, and they point to where it is. So we know it's there. Everyone knows that the hard work hasn't been done to actually reform the MBS. And as our approach to managing chronic disease is changing, then so too must the way that the government remunerates the medical profession for managing what is increasingly our burden of disease.
Now, I know that the government has, of course, talked a lot about the need to make Medicare sustainable, and you yourself had suggested that it's inefficient and bloated. But isn't this over-egging the problem somewhat? Is it not true that Australia's health costs, in fact, compare quite well internationally?
Difficult to compare our health costs with other countries, given that we have a different system with the states and the federal government and the private health sector as well. What I really want to look at is how can we work constructively with the states to keep people out of hospital, and in so doing, keep their budgets as low as possible our budgets as low as possible and the health of all Australians as good as possible. So, you know, I often say when you add money to the social services portfolio, people get more. When you add more money to the health portfolio, sometimes it's because people are sicker or people are in hospital instead of in primary care. So we've got a real opportunity with the reform of the Federation and the conversation that I will have with state ministers to do this much better across the board.
Of course, sometimes when you add money, it's because people are demanding more services and technology is enabling people to buy more in terms of healthcare. Isn't that true?
That's absolutely true. And the challenge for our health portfolios across the world is to keep the cost curve coming down, because that's absolutely what happens. Technology and better medicines and longer lives that we'll all be living, all of which are things we should be celebrating, all of which we should see as challenges and never as problems, are certainly adding to the demand for health expenditure. But underpinning all this is the patient. The patient, the patient experience, and the patient's journey through our current health system. And at the moment, it's clunky, it's inefficient. We'll be talking about e-health in the budget, which is a really good, you know, positive microeconomic reform that keeps costs down and keeps patients well.
The Australian Medical Association President Brian Owler strikes me as a pretty canny politician in his own right. How have you found dealing with him?
Really well, actually. Brian is a paediatric neurosurgeon and is someone whose skill in the operating theatre is well recognised. I absolutely respect that, as I do all of our medical professionals. And I've sat down and talked to Brian about lots of things in the health sector. We don't always agree, nor should we. His job is to advocate for his members, and my job is to advocate for taxpayers and get the best deal for patients. But we have a collegiate working relationship.
Is he a tough negotiator?
Look, I think he's tough when he needs to be. I'm tough when I need to be, but we respect each other's different viewpoints. And ultimately, we know that if we bring the medical profession with us, as I believe we are doing, we keep the public happy. The public accepts that our government and our doctors are doing things together that make sense. I think the public is unhappy when they think we're at war with the medical profession. And at war, by the way, is a much overused term. But I think they like to see us working constructively. That's my intention.
We hear from time to time, of course, a lot of talk about the need to put more emphasis on preventative medicine and stopping people being obese and all the modern lifestyle problems. How seriously do you take that? And do you think that that requires some more active intervention by government on occasion, for example, advertising of junk foods, areas of that sort?
Michelle, I think preventative health is the next big frontier, and it's an area I'm personally very interested in. It sounds very simplistic, but doctors say to me, we spend all our time telling people how not to get sicker, when in fact we don't spend enough time telling them how to stay well. And we also know that for governments, the investment we make in almost pre-primary practice, so before you even present with something that you believe needs fixing, there is work that we can do. So screening is a good example of that, and the cancer screening measures that we're announcing in the budget, including a national registry, are vital, because screening is something that happens often before you see any symptoms whatsoever. So around the junk food tax, sugar tax, look, it may on one level be appealing, but ultimately this is not about dictating to people, it's about educating them, and I know that's difficult. As a previous childcare minister, I believe that with one of the biggest challenges we face, which is obesity, by the time the child can reach the fridge door, it's often too late. There is a programming, as I'm told by our obesity experts, within that person's DNA that makes it incredibly difficult. I have enormous sympathy with people who struggle with obesity, and I think they're unfairly targeted, and I would like to support them. People have addictions to prescription drugs and alcohol and gambling, and they can effectively operate in society and no one knows, but somebody who's obese gets picked on, gets, all sorts of things all the way through the system.
So, but this was a lesser problem for previous generations, so it's not as though it's not something you can find a way to deal with.
We have to find a way to deal with it. We're second only in the world with the so-called obesity epidemic. The US, of course, is number one. We have to find a way to deal with it. It is a challenge for governments, and it's important that we, again, my focus on chronic disease management through how we will redevelop that area is about a patient having a usual doctor who they see on a regular basis, who understands them and what their life is like, and who helps and encourages them. So that's a relationship that works. And while we can, piece of jargon, incentivize that relationship, we've got a good chance of bringing in measures to tackle obesity, other chronic disease, including asthma and diabetes and mental illness and so on.
Now, you mentioned war before and war with the doctors. Well, there seems to be a truce there, but the war with the pharmacists seems to be still in its hot stage, and they say that the $18.9 billion offer that you have on the table for the new five-year agreement is not really that much. It's more like $16 billion when the swings and roundabouts are taken into account. Where do you think this is all going to land?
The $18.9 billion figure is in the ballpark. Finance works very closely with costings, and I'm certainly not in the business of presenting amounts that are not real. And while the reports today talk about that figure and a few others, I can say that they're definitely in the ballpark when it comes to the negotiations we're having with pharmacy. It's definitely not unfriendly. It's a robust negotiation, I think that's fair to say, and that's what one would expect. The Pharmacy Guild is doing the best for their members. I'm doing the best for taxpayers and affordability for consumers.
Now, the pharmacists also say that your proposal to have chemists discount by a dollar prescriptions, in fact, while sounding good for consumers, will really bring a zero benefit for concession card holders. It will just take them longer to reach the safety net, after which they get free drugs. What's your response on this?
20% of concession card holders reach the safety net. The others, I am sure, will appreciate the opportunity to have drugs on prescription for a dollar less than they're paying now in terms of their own co-payment. This proposal is not mandatory. It can be offered by a pharmacist or it cannot. So we have, as I'm sure you know, a series of reports from the Audit Office, from the Harper Review, from various productivity commissions over the years, becoming quite insistent about the need for competition in the pharmacy sector. Part of the National Medicines Policy is a viable community pharmacy sector, and can I say, as a rural and regional Member of Parliament, I'm absolutely committed to that. And we want our pharmacists to be strong, and we recognise the role that they play. This negotiation, as I said, is, I hope, about to conclude, but it's a good deal for pharmacy, it's a good deal for consumers, it's a good deal for the suppliers of medicines, it's a good deal for government. I think it's landed in the right place across the board, and everyone along the supply chain for medicines has a role in investing in the future, including new drugs, which we have to list on the PBS. I've got about $3 billion worth of listings of new drugs in front of me now. We don't get new money when new drugs arrive. We want to be able to offer these medicines to people with secondary cancers, with melanoma, with breast cancer, as I've just announced on the weekend. And we don't want a system that we see in other countries where those leading edge drugs are not available. So we have to work with everyone across the supply chain, and I'm comfortable with where we are today.
Now, you mentioned competition, and of course the Harper Review recently suggested that the rule should be abolished or phased out, whereby pharmacists can't set up within, I think it's a kilometre and a half of each other, new pharmacies. Are you going to abolish that rule? And if not, why wouldn't you?
It makes sense to have a two-year review of remuneration and location rules, and the Pharmacy Guild is very welcoming of that. They're happy to have this examined over the next couple of years in more detail, and that may well be part of the agreement that we finally do sign up to. I look at a lot of requests to provide ministerial exemptions to the location rules, so clearly they're not working that well. I've said my personal view is I don't want to see pharmacy in supermarkets at the moment. I value the role that our community pharmacists do. I also know that competition is important, and it's important for the best deal for consumers. And the discounted up to $1 co-payment option provides pharmacy with tools for competition and should, in the medium term, keep the, you know, the audit office, the Productivity Commission and so on, who are distinguished bodies that we believe have good things to say about economic, you know, the structure of the economy and how best to achieve the supports across the supply chain that everyone demands. And I think this is going to be a very good deal for everyone involved.
Just looking at your portfolio at a macro level, in this budget, there will be savings in total in health?
There will be savings in health, and I think my total
overall.
Overall, yes.
Can you give some indication of a round figure?
Perhaps not a round figure, but we will have
several billion.
We will have taken responsible steps to do the task that we have in the health portfolio to commit to the national savings effort. It is a balance between reinvesting in important reforms and realising efficiencies where they exist. So tomorrow's budget will show that, and we've also got to keep a weather eye on the Senate and appreciate the fact that these measures need to be supported by the Senate. The Pharmacy Guild agreement and changes to the PBS are a good example of that. So in structuring results or policies that meet the approval of all of the supply chain, my intention is that they meet the approval of the Senate as well, and we don't get into a stoush as we did as we have from time to time in the past.
Well, they've also, in the longer run, got to meet the approval of the voters. Moving around your electorate and the rest of Australia, do you feel that voters are more willing to be or are willing to be open-minded about this budget, given what did happen last year?
I think they are. I think there's great understanding that the government does have a savings task. The $40 million a day that we're paying in interest alone is a figure that, while people don't have it at the top of their mind, it certainly concerns them when you mention it. But they're also comfortable with a steady-as-she-goes approach, and they understand that if we go too hard too early, they're concerned about that as well. So I believe they will give us a tick for this budget for progressing in the direction that we know we need to for the country, that it is about jobs and growth and opportunity. It is about maintaining our standard of living. And as rural and regional members, which I am first and foremost, it needs to be good for small business and it needs to be good for rural Australia, and I believe it will be.
You've only been in this portfolio since December, and it's a very demanding one. It's a complex area and you've had tough negotiations. How difficult a learning curve has that been? Do you feel that you're really across it yet, or are you still to some extent on training wheels?
There's always more to learn, but I'm comfortable with the broad streams of funding and the broad policy parameters. I think it's important as a new minister that you cover that off as early as possible. I will always talk to to doctors, to clinicians, to patients, to allied health professionals, to nurses. You know, the day I think, well, I haven't really got anything to learn from the sector is the day I think I should retire. So
it's really
exciting to be able to meet individuals. I was in Sydney last week. I sat down at a coffee shop opposite a major hospital with a neuroradiologist, I may have got that wrong, and talked about some really cutting-edge medical technology in the treatment of strokes. And it was interesting because while being fascinated with that example, it was a really good way of highlighting that the MBS doesn't have the items there for the procedures that are happening and how all these really good people have to sort of work around an existing and outdated structure to get the results they want, and the public and private systems and private health insurance and all of those other providers are in the mix as well. It's a complex picture with many moving parts, but fascinating and challenging.
When you took over the portfolio, you also moved up to Cabinet, becoming the second woman in Cabinet. I just wonder, with this very busy area, how much time do you need to put in before each Cabinet meeting working over other people's submissions for those general discussions? Is it a few hours or a day or half a day?
I certainly put time aside for that, and it may well be a few hours depending on the items that are on the list. It's a funny thing. People said, oh, you're the second woman in Cabinet. My answer is, well, I'm the third rural and regional member, maybe the fourth. But that's a very important hat that I wear around that Cabinet table. So if there are any measures that are specific to rural and regional Australia, I pay particular attention. You know, I might call the relevant ministers and
beforehand
and just have a chat to make sure that I understand what's being proposed, and they likewise do the same for me for my items. Yes, it's a very constructive process. An enormous amount of work gets done at the Cabinet table, but an enormous amount of work happens before you even get there.
So you would try and get across all portfolios from Defence to Attorney General's, as well as your rural and regional material?
Well, it's not possible to understand the other portfolios in as much depth as one understands one's own, and I'm not going to pretend for a minute that I can. So I think the important thing is to approach those other portfolios as almost a neutral agent, as the public would, and if you can hear the messages from Cabinet colleagues in the way that your constituents would, it's a bit like being a backbencher on their topics. And I like the fact that they do that with me, because once you get into the detail of a portfolio and then have to step right back outside and say, well, how does this look to the punter? Yeah, it's great to have that advice. And on that subject, the backbench committee is vital to me. So at 3 o'clock today, I'm going to talk to my backbench colleagues from across the country, and I've invited, well, the secretary of the committee, David Gillespie, will, I know, have invited everyone to come in and thrash out their ideas and their thoughts on the budget so far. And again, that just gives me the eyes and ears on the ground across the country.
Susan Lee, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. We'll have a full coverage of the budget. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. Talk to you again soon.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.